I'm Chris Kresser, and this is Revolution Health Radio. Hey everybody, it's Chris Kresser. Welcome to another episode of Revolution Health Radio. Today we're going to be talking with Diana Rogers. She's a registered dietitian with a private practice seeing people via Skype and in her offices in Concord and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and lives on a working organic farm. She's the author of the Homegrown Paleo Cookbook and Paleo Lunches and Breakfasts on the Go, and hosts the Sustainable Dish podcast. Diana frequently writes and speaks about the political, social justice, animal welfare, and environmental issues in the food system, and she runs the blog SustainableDish.com. Diana has recently written a series of articles about the environmental, moral, and ethical, and social issues surrounding meat consumption and dietary choices that we make in general. So I wanted to have Diana on the show to talk to her about this because I think for many people, at least at this point, they are no longer believe that vegetarian or vegan diet is the best choice from a nutritional perspective, or at least they don't necessarily believe that it's superior to an omnivorous diet that is nutrient dense and excludes, you know, processed and refined foods, sugars, etc. But they are still compelled to consider a vegetarian or vegan diet on the basis of environmental reasons or moral and ethical reasons. And it seems like almost every week there's a new article published documenting the environmental atrocities of consuming animal foods, like water consumption and land use and things like that. In fact, there was just an article published in the Washington Post called Meat is Murder that was written by an intern who had just graduated from college and really, unfortunately, wasn't qualified to write that article. But nevertheless, it got a lot of airtime and it was filled with inaccuracies and misconceptions that are quite common now amongst the general public and in the mainstream media. So I wanted to have Diana on the show to talk about this because she has a unique perspective, both as a dietitian who understands the nutritional perspective, but as someone who owns and operates a working organic farm, is closely connected with the cycle of life, raises animals, food for her own family and also for other people, and has written and spoken about this extensively. So without further ado, let's dive in. This episode of Revolution Health Radio is brought to you by 14-4.me. 14-4 is a diet and lifestyle reset program I created to help you dial in the four pillars of health: nutrition, physical activity, sleep, and stress management. Whether you want to lose weight, boost your energy, treat a chronic health problem, or just maintain your current good health and extend your lifespan, these are the four areas you need to focus on before anything else. In the 14-4 program, I walk you through every step of the process, from cleaning out your pantry and shopping for the right foods, to recipe and meal plans, to video demos of workouts that you can do at home without any special equipment, to guided meditation and stress management programs, to daily sleep tips, to personalized recommendations for what to do after you finish the reset. 14-4 is a great option whether you're just getting started with this stuff or you've been on the path for a while. In fact, I do a 14-4 myself 3 or 4 times a year to hit the reset button and give myself a boost. To learn more about how 14-4 can help you achieve your health goals, head over to 14-4.me. Okay, now back to the show. Diana, thanks so much for coming. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about meat, all about eating meat, producing meat, the environmental, ethical implications of that, and then, you know, by extension, the implications of avoiding meat, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on this topic, whether we're talking about the amount of water that you need to produce meat, to the impact of meat production on carbon emissions, to some of the ethical considerations, which I don't think there's so much of a misunderstanding there as much as perhaps just not a complete analysis. So I know these are all huge topics. We could spend an entire show easily on each of them, yeah, individually, but I want to just have one place to do kind of an overview of all of these to And then, you know, we can point people in the direction of more information in the show notes for those who want to go deeper. So why don't we start with the environmental considerations of meat production? Because it seems like there's a new article in the mainstream press about this, you know, on a weekly basis. In fact, there were just a few that you can probably mention that provoked you to write a couple of responses. So why don't we start there and then we'll progress to, you know, ethical and maybe even public health considerations.
Yeah, well, first of all, I just wanted to say thank you for all your nutritional research on meat, because I have been linking back to you in all of these posts, and I feel like the nutrition argument has been won, and I can just send them to you. So that's awesome.
Pleasure.
And also, I should mention that Rob Wolf and I are working on a book. We're just starting the outline now, but we should have kind of all these things buttoned up. And, you know, definitely the environmental argument is really misunderstood. And the moral argument seems to be the one that just always goes there.
Yeah.
So the environmental argument, you know, really, there was an article that came out recently in the Washington Post that's called Meat is Horrible. And it was written by, I did a little research on who wrote it, and She just graduated from college this year. She's an intern. I was surprised that the Washington Post actually had her do such a complex topic, because right. I've been living on a farm for a long time. I went to school for nutrition, and, you know, even I don't feel like I don't fully understand everything. But basically, the vilification of meat tends to come from people who have these moral issues with meat, and then they're just kind of cherry picking information to back up their claims. So there's a lot of different angles that they hit the environmental piece with. So the first is that land use, that, you know, it takes, you know, all these acres for per cow. And what they're not really looking at is that there's a difference between pasture land and cropland. And you can't grow lettuce everywhere. Northern Africa, you know, really great for olives, really bad for lettuce because of the water issues there. Lots of California, you know, used to be okay for growing lots of vegetables, and now you guys are totally running out of water.
Yep.
And so, you know, vegetable production is not this holy saint that everyone's making it out to be. And that's a whole nother set of things. But pasture land is a separate type of land that can't be used for vegetable production. And the grazing of cattle on pasture actually helps improve the soils. And so,
how does it do that?
Okay. So the cows are pooping on the ground, and their manure actually has a lot of bionutrients in it, and microbes and all kinds of great stuff that goes into the soil and actually inoculates it. And actually, on a side note, I should say that people are realizing this, and they're actually, instead of using cattle to do this, are actually just walking around with these big syringes and inoculating soil with cow manure.
Right.
Which is just so dumb to me. Why not just have cows on it?
Well, the alternative is also chemical fertilizers, which has been the kind of de facto standard here in the U.S., right? And what are some of the problems with that?
Right. The problem with that is it completely depletes the soil. Glyphosate basically kills all. So soil is not just sand, and it's not just like what people think of as dirt. It's actually, you know, lots and lots of living things. And so we want biodiversity in our gut flora. We want biodiversity out in nature. And we want biodiversity in soil, because that biodiversity actually helps sequester carbon. So as the plants are going through photosynthesis, carbon is channeled into the plant's roots. And then there's about between 5 and 21% photosynthetically fixed as carbon into the soil. And then the fungus and all the other microbiome of the soil actually helps transfer nutrients to the plants. And so we're having this big problem right now with, you know, nutrient depletion, and people are suffering from, you know, lack of minerals. And that's because we're not farming properly in nutrient-rich soil. That really can only happen when the soil has a mix of all the stuff soil needs, basically lots of compost, deep-rooted plants, and things like that. So in addition, these deep roots and all this great stuff that's happening in the soil actually helps with water retention so that when the rain falls, the water doesn't just run away. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's happening in a lot of really arid places that, you know, have turned into sort of like dust bowl areas. So they've been overgrazed or they've been, you know, monocropped forever and completely void of any sort of life living in the soil. And now when it rains, the water just flows right away instead of going deep into the soil and being able to be held in the soil.
So none of this is particularly new information, is it? Organic, you know, farmers, people who were farming prior to the advent of chemical fertilizers, which is for the vast majority of human history, you know, where we've been farming and raising animals, the last 11,000 years or so, these were the standard practices, right? Using bone and blood and manure.
Definitely in vegetable production. And then, you know, the loss of herbivores, the killing off of the bison actually contributed a lot to our loss of prairie land, you know, all through the middle of the country as well.
Wait, there were how many bison roaming around? What was the estimate there?
I think, well, I see different numbers. I think I'm comfortable saying about 30 million bison.
Yeah. So that's a huge, you know, we should have had our atmosphere, you know, catching on fire.
Right. And it wasn't just bison, right? Mm-hmm. That's just one of the species that was roaming around. We had elk, we had deer, we had all kinds of, you know, these awful methane farting animals mm-hmm. running all over the place. And so there's not actually, you know, the amount of cattle that are here today being raised for food production isn't
a fraction of that.
Right. And what's happening is when we raise them in confinement, like, well, I should back up. So most cattle aren't just raised in factory sheds and barns like pigs and chickens are. So actually, if you were to have to pick one evil animal to eat that was, you know, like from our industrial food system, I would actually argue that cows are the best choice above chicken and pigs. Mm-hmm. Just because chicken and pigs are 100% indoors, where most of the cattle actually start on grass. So cows are grass fed, and then usually, you know, the last portion of their life, they're moved to a feedlot. But when we're moving them to the feedlot, they're standing around, you know, everyone knows what these images are because we're flooded with them all the time from all these, you know, vegan propaganda movies, mm-hmm. but it is not great. So all the manure is completely concentrated in this very anaerobic environment. And, you know, the rules are, you know, that the manure has to sit for, I believe it's 90 days before it can be spread on crops. But that's pretty much the only rule about it. And so that's a really good petri dish of, you know, toxic bacteria that then just gets sprayed directly on our spinach and things like that. So when we hear about all these E. coli outbreaks and everything, that's how it happens.
Right. So, you know, we're talking about the problems with conventional meat production are to a large extent symptomatic of a kind of divorce from the natural cycle of input and output that should be happening.
Correct.
And, you know, you mentioned earlier, I just want to go back to this and highlight this for people, that is also happening in terms of how we use or misuse land. Like it was understood even by early farming peoples that if just growing one crop in a particular place over and over again was not a recipe for preserving soil health. And they also knew how to make use of different kinds of land that weren't necessarily suitable for plant production. So one of the arguments you often hear against eating meat is that we can't possibly feed the planet if everyone's eating meat, and that land use and water use are often pointed to in support of that argument. So let's talk a little bit more about that.
Right. So we're utilizing not very much of our available pasture land by percentage. And I forget off the top of my head what the percentages are. I presented on it at AHS, and I should pull up the presentation so I have the numbers in front of me. But, you know, what people are thinking is that, well, if we just eat only vegetables, then we'll be pure and we don't have to have any deaths and we can feed everybody this way. And what they're not realizing is that, well, then we're not using the pasture land at all. So then we're not using any of the pasture land because you can't grow vegetables in, you know, very good vegetables in much of Africa. You know, you can grow some root crops and there's some areas where you can grow vegetables, but there's a lot of places on the globe where it just doesn't make sense to grow the variety of vegetables that we need in order to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not going to utilize the pasture land for grazing animals, we're going to lose the pasture land and it's just going to turn into dust. And so if we're going to preserve the pasture land by utilizing herbivores in order to sequester the carbon and to help grow grass. So I'll just kind of walk through what happens when an herbivore is on a piece of pasture. So they're walking around, their hoof prints actually make little indentations, which helps hold water. They're chewing on the grass, which stimulates growth. When you cut grass, it grows. We don't want the grass to just biologically break down on its own. We want it to be chewed, digested, and spit out the other end with microbes in it. And that's really the healthiest way to do it. And then we want to be moving them around. So we don't want the animals on the same piece of land all the time. We want to be mimicking what natural herds have been doing forever, you know, because they've been sort of migrating, you know, moving away from predators. We can do that now with electric fencing. So on our farm and Joel Salatin's farm and all the really truly sustainable farms, the animals are moved all the time. On our farm, the sheep are moving around the farm. They're usually followed by the chickens, which our mobile chickens actually can eat some of the parasites that are there, if there are any, from the sheep. And that actually makes the sheep healthier because it cuts down on the parasite load. If you keep the animals on the same piece of land all the time, one sick sheep will inoculate all the sheep and make for poor soil. So by moving them around a lot, you reduce their parasite load, you keep healthier soil, and you have healthier animals.
That makes an incredible amount of sense.
What you really want to do is, instead of having one animal on an entire acre all the time, you would have, you know, 30 animals on an acre and then just move it constantly. So when you hear these numbers of, well, it takes, you know, all this land to raise, you know, whatever herbivore, a cow or a sheep, you can't really compare that to wheat production or corn production. Right. It's just not fair.
The number I think you used in one of your articles, and it was from the Tufts study on the sustainability of various dietary approaches, was that 2/3 of the surface land in the world is not suitable for vegetable production. And they found that, you know, a vegetarian diet may be sustainable, but a vegan diet was definitely not sustainable from a land use perspective.
Yeah. And then I actually emailed the professor and asked him a little bit more if we kind of cut down our consumption of grain eating animals and increased our consumption of herbivores, how might that look?
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't get back to me on that.
Right.
But I think, you know, that we need to consider that. Like here at our house, we eat a lot more herbivores than we do chicken or grain fed. You know, we're more into the grass eating animals here.
Mm-hmm. Well, they make more sense from a number of perspectives. I mean, if one consideration, which we'll talk about more later, the ethical and moral argument, you know, a single cow can feed a lot more people than a chicken can.
Right.
And just, you know, from the perspective of maximizing caloric density and value, the large herbivores are a lot more efficient that way than the smaller animals. And as you said, it's almost impossible to, unless you're doing it yourself, to buy, you know, completely pasture-raised chicken or pork.
That's the number one seller here, actually, above lamb, is our pastured pork. Pastured chicken, it's just really hard for people to wrap their heads around paying $30 for a chicken.
For a scrawny little chicken.
A scrawny, stringy chicken,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So people are just so conditioned, you know, unfortunately,
see, like the breast augmented chickens that we're used to
that will have a heart attack and die at 5 weeks if you don't kill them first.
And like topple over forwards because they're so breast heavy.
Right. And, you know, and it's really, you know, and we haven't even discussed, I feel like we're going in a million different directions. Mm-hmm. And this is such a complex topic, but we haven't even talked about antibiotic resistant superbugs, which are just, it's really scary what's happening in CAFOs. You know, if you wanted to have a perfect environment for a major public health crisis, it would be at one of these like chicken or pork factory farms.
Yeah. And let's be clear. I mean, we'll get back to what we were talking about. This is an important diversion though. And I've written a lot about the difference between CAFO and pasture-raised animal products before. And, you know, maybe we'll do a separate show on that again, because I think that, you know, it's time for an update. But let me just be 100% clear. I in no way endorse or support CAFO meat. And that's one area where I agree with vegans. I think it's not sustainable. It's cruel. It's a health train wreck waiting to happen, you know, because, especially because of the growing problem of antibiotic resistant bacteria, which I think is probably the single biggest reason to avoid eating CAFO meat, if you can, of all of the reasons, like the scariest, you know, most potentially serious reason. And so that's, I think, one potential area of common ground where we are all recognizing that this modern food system that we've created, actually, whether you're talking about animal products or plants, vegetables, is not sustainable.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing, you know, when vegans say, well, I won't eat meat because I don't believe in factory farming, it's like saying I won't eat vegetables because I don't believe in monocrop GMOs.
And, you better stay away from wheat and soy. And since soy is in just about any food that comes in a bag or a box, that eliminates virtually all packaged and processed foods, you know, even vegan cookies, for example. Partially hydrogenated soybean oil and a lot of that kind of stuff. So yeah, let's just agree that this system is not sustainable, but let's get back to what is sustainable. And, you know, so we've touched briefly on water. We talked about land use and the importance of herbivores to soil health. I think some of the statistics that I saw in one of your articles were that agricultural soils have lost somewhere between 30 and 70% of their soil organic carbon, which is just devastating. I mean, this is like the stuff of life, you know, that we cannot just go, you know, easily replace it. We can't just go to the soil organic carbon store and buy this and easily put it back in.
Right.
But regenerative grazing of cattle can produce a 30 to 40% improvement in soil carbon. So let's talk a little bit more about this in terms of inputs and outputs.
Sure. And I should mention in these studies too about water and the difference between green water and blue water as well. So, you know, because so when these studies come out, they're not really looking at what you said, you know, the inputs and outputs. So a true life cycle analysis is where they're actually looking at the whole entire picture and not just, for example, carbon emissions, right? So if they're looking at pure carbon emissions, yes, cows emit a lot of methane, but then you take into account the carbon sequestration that cattle can have on the land. Plus, there's microbes in the soil, which can also help mitigate some of that methane. It's actually a net gain. So people have to look at the entire picture. And it's the same thing with water when you hear that, you know, it takes, and again, you're really good at reciting numbers. I'm not.
just the way my brain works.
You know, so it takes like, I don't know, what it is, it like 50,000 gallons of water for a pound of beef or something silly. Whatever the number is, it's silly.
Yeah.
And so what they're not realizing is that these studies are also looking at, they're including rainwater in the mix. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference between green water and blue water. So green water includes precipitation, runoff, water needed for the crop growth, and, you know, water that is sinking into the ground. So it's all of that water is being calculated in order to produce that piece of hamburger that everyone's vilifying so much. Mm-hmm. And when you actually look at the blue water, so that's just fresh surface groundwater like lakes and rivers and aquifers that the cattle are drinking, the number of gallons per pound of beef is actually
a lot more. 410.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that number in my head.
I remember that number too. I was so, you beat me to it.
All right. So 410, and how does that compare to like some other foods?
So it's very similar to rice, sugar, avocados, almonds, you know, a lot of these foods that I'm not hearing a whole lot of complaining about. So, and then when you look at grass-fed, 100% grass-fed beef, Nicolette Nyman, in her book, Defending Beef, explains that grass-fed beef is a lot closer to 100 gallons per pound of water, 2 per pound of beef.
So a quarter of that that's required to grow rice and avocados and walnuts and sugar. So yeah, that paints a very different picture, especially when you consider, you know, as we've been saying all along here, that these animals are not just completely separate from the rest of the system and cycle of food production, that they're actually improving soil health, they're sequestering carbon to where there's a, you know, a net sequestration of carbon rather than an emission of carbon. They're increasing biodiversity and they're essentially depositing into that bank account. If we consider the soil like as a bank account, which is an analogy that you've used, cropping and planting vegetables is withdrawing nutrients, but these herbivores are depositing, right? They're putting stuff back in.
Correct. And the other thing that just kills me, and you know, this goes back to the nutrition piece, but when people compare beef, you know, and the water usage to something like rice, right? Or avocados, and it's like, you know, that's not really even fair because of the nutrient density of beef compared to these other things, you know. And then you look at this lab-grown meats that they're making, and a product like tofurkey. You know, I have not seen a life cycle analysis on these things, and Rob and I have been trying to, you know, pin somebody down to do it for us just so we have the numbers for our book. But, you know, how much water is needed in the processing and growing of all the soy and wheat that's necessary to make, you know, one package of tofurkey? Or these lab-grown meats, which I think people are somehow thinking are just created out of magic and no inputs at all.
Right.
Who's paying for the lab? Who's paying for all the trucking, all the storage required? I mean, like, even just storing that product requires a ton of energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've, I think, given a good overview of the environmental considerations of meat and how it's much more complex than these mainstream articles make it out to be. They're often missing key components of the equation. Having said that, we both agree that CAFO meat is just like CAFO or conventional farming in general is not sustainable. And, you know, really it's difficult to defend. So let's move on to the ethical and moral considerations of meat, because I think some people who are really well informed, who are vegetarians and vegans, people I know, for example, and who are friends of mine, they're fairly convinced on the nutritional front, and they supplement and, you know, try to take steps to mitigate some of the potential nutritional downsides. They're even, although, you know, maybe some concerned about the environmental considerations, the people I'm thinking of are open-minded enough to have read, you know, other accounts that include these kinds of variables, and they may not be convinced that it's a bad thing, particularly, you know, sustainable local small farm meat production. But the ethical and moral consideration is where they diverge. You know, just the idea of killing another animal in order to feed themselves is objectionable, and that's what stops them from doing it. So, you know, we're now entering territory that's less about scientific studies and data and objective facts and more about subjective considerations. But I do think you raised several interesting points in the article you wrote about this on Rob's website that were coming from your experience as a farmer and someone who raises animals for food, both for your own family and for other people. So let's talk a little bit about this, because I think there's some things that maybe people haven't considered.
Right. And I actually did find a study on this out of Finland, where they were interviewing sort of ethical meat and non-meat eaters and what was their driving force. And the moral piece is the biggest piece. And I remember just messaging Rob like, oh my God, we really have to pay a lot of attention, even though he and I both are like poo-poo it, right? We're like, ugh. We really have to be very sensitive to this because it's a really big piece to this. And so I've been asking a lot of people, because I don't really get it personally, because I'm so connected and understand so well that, you know, we need animal inputs in order to have vegetable outputs, and that we're just all matter that's just being recycled, right? That, you know, I just happen to be made up of all these cells right now, and then one day these different minerals and everything are just going to be part of a tree or whatever. But not everybody thinks that way, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do with the people that don't think that way? So I talked to Joel Salatin when I was down at an event at Polyface just last month about, you know, what does he say? And I've been asking lots of other philosophers too, like how they argue it. And so Joel was like, well, if you don't think you need death in order to have life, just lay down naked in a flower bed for 3 days and tell me what happens, right?
Right.
So, you know, and he went into it from a Christian perspective because, you know, a lot of people who are more religious don't like the whole matter recycling thing. And they actually, a lot of them, which I learned recently from another philosopher, they don't like the you can kill one animal to save all these other animals. Mm-hmm. They don't like that argument either, because who's to say that that one life isn't going to go on and do amazing things or something? Like, right. Like one life isn't equal to whatever. So right. That was a shocker to me too. I didn't really think about things that way. Anyhow, so Joel was going on further about how, you know, humans actually are the only ones that are consciously humane when we're trying to, you know, move an animal to the next phase of its existence. And, you know, hyenas and coyotes, they don't care about that.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the big pieces is that if we need the animals for soil health, why can't we just let them live out a natural life and a natural death? And the idea that a natural death is a painless death or a better death than a humane slaughter that we can do with all the technology that we have today is crazy. And I think that we're pretty divorced from the fact that we die. And so that's part of it. And that most people are not part of seeing how animals are raised and how they're killed. Like that's not part of their daily existence. Meat comes in a plastic container, wrapped, you know, at the grocery store. And the only images are the horrible images that we see from these vegan propaganda movies. And that's what people think. And they think, oh, well, you know, a natural death. And they think of like, you know, butterflies and daisies and these deer, like, you know, just walking around forever. And unfortunately, you know, life is really great when you're strong and young and healthy. And life isn't really that great when you have like a broken leg and you're like a herd animal, right? And there's a hyena behind you. Then life's not so great.
Right. And what happens with, you know, factory farming? You know, like let's consider a field of a, you know, row crop of some kind. What kind of animals are at risk in that type of operation?
Oh, right. Yes. I mean, there's tons. I like to bring up how many bunnies live in these, you know, soy fields and wheat fields, because people tend to, like when you're talking about all the different creatures, bunnies is the one that really gets people. So these fields are teeming with life. They've got all kinds of little mammals that are running through them that, you know, when a tractor is coming through and harvesting the corn, all those animals die. And then if we think about all the biodiversity that's lost from spraying of chemicals and, you know, all the bees that die, all the butterflies, all the birds that eat bees and butterflies, the loss of just the natural landscape from turning a field from whatever it was, either a forest or, you know, a pasture to cropland. I mean, there's a lot of devastation that happens from a vegan or vegetarian type diet. So it's not a bloodless diet.
Yeah, I think one of the things you wrote in what in your article or when during the presentation, I can't remember, was, you know, consider the way that a group of baby voles might die if their mother was decapitated by a, you know, a combine versus a quick and humane death of a cow in a humane slaughterhouse. And those are pretty different pictures if you imagine both of those. But I think for me, one of the things that stands out, and this is again more of a, you know, it's less quantifiable, but it's this profound separation between human beings and nature that seems to pervade modern industrial society. And if you consider a lot of traditional hunter-gatherer populations, like, this idea would have never even occurred to them because they're so inexorably intertwined with the environment in which they live. And yet, you know, we are, I think, have the sense that we're somehow, first of all, that we're different. We're not animals anymore. And we're somehow removed from all that. And then I think there's also just a sense of loss and separation that's come from that. And that's actually informing a lot of these discussions.
Right. You know, and I've seen, well, first of all, in the hunter-gatherer societies, you think about, you know, what you might have seen on TV about, you know, these cultures, but they, when an animal's slaughtered, like a goat or something, there's usually like a whole kind of ritual around that, right? Like, they're honoring it, they're using all the pieces, and it's like, you know, a big deal. Or if they hunt something and bring it back, there's like a celebration and a feast and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot more than just throwing some burgers on the grill, you know,
right?
Whatever.
Right.
So, and, you know, and I am actually writing a piece right now on humane slaughter for a magazine in New England, and just got back from a slaughterhouse in Vermont where they actually invite people to come watch. Mm-hmm. They've got like a viewing deck and you can watch it. It's called Vermont Packing House, and it's in Springfield, Vermont. And, you know, it's really quick, and they have figured it out. You know, they're animal welfare approved, which is a great organization. I actually just talked to the head of that today, and they have, you know, figured out how to make it as, you know, humane as it can be versus just about any other death I've ever seen out. You know, sometimes, you know, a chicken might have a heart attack from a thunderstorm. So that's a pretty good way to go. But other than that, I can't really picture a whole lot of natural deaths that I would want for myself, other than, you know, something like what they do in these slaughterhouses.
So there's another argument that's often used, which is, okay, so some of these animals die in the production of my baguette.
I know where you're going.
But I didn't ask for them to be killed. You know, it wasn't my intent that they were killed. Whereas if I'm going to eat a burger, I'm fully aware that an animal has lost his or her life in order to feed me. So that, you know, that's different from an ethical perspective.
Right. Yeah. So that's always a big piece of these arguments. And so that one is pretty easily dismantled because, you know, a death is a death.
It is once you listen to this podcast or you become aware that, you know, I think there maybe are people who don't actually, maybe quite a few people who don't actually realize that eating plants involves death and maybe more death in terms of individual lives than eating animals. But once you become aware of that, it's hard to continue making that argument, honestly.
Right. I mean, once you've heard this, or once, you know, like, I wrote it in really big, bold letters on Rob's site. So I am now officially telling you that animals are dying. You know, is it still better to eat just vegetables? No, it's not.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So this is probably going to invite just as many questions as it answers. You know, I think maybe we can finish up by talking a little bit about something I posted on my Facebook page, which you also in turn wrote an article about. And it was a news story about Italy, where they are considering jail for vegan parents or parents that impose a vegan diet on their children. You know, why would they possibly consider doing that?
Right. And I don't know if you've noticed a theme here, but all the ones where I know we're going to get a lot of crazy comments, I post on Rob's site instead of my own site.
Yeah.
So I actually brought this up again, when I was down at Polyface Farm. There was a panel of us, and we're all sitting there, a bunch of, you know, leaders in the nutrition movement. And we're talking about sort of this libertarian idea that government should stay out, right, and not have anything to do with our food choices at all. And I know a lot of people think that. But I do think that there's a really big difference between a standard American junk food diet that, you know, can cause obesity, type 2 diabetes perhaps, and permanent brain damage that has been documented in children of vegan parents who've been fed a vegan diet. And where these kids don't have any control over that. So Drew Ramsey, have you met him yet?
Mm-hmm. I have, yeah.
Yeah. So I was sitting next to him, and he and I were pretty much the only ones on the panel that were like, no, this is a really big deal. And I don't know if jail necessarily is the answer, but I think the whole conversation is really interesting, because whose responsibility is it when there's, and is this neglect?
Yeah.
So our opinion was, yes, it's neglectful and it's inappropriate to feed children a vegan diet. You can do whatever you want with yourself, but don't do this to children, because it's really dangerous. And B12 supplementation doesn't always, you know, fix things.
Yeah, and it could be too little, too late. And if the wrong form is used, it can be inadequate. It's a really, really difficult topic. I mean, when I first saw that headline, I was surprised, to be honest. I was like, wow, this is crazy. And I'm someone who knows a lot about, you know, the potential issues here. And my first reaction also was similar to, I'm not a libertarian, but it was similar to that response, because it's not hard to imagine all of the disastrous things that could happen if the government started, you know, levying fines and even imposing jail time on us for our dietary choices, you know.
Well, and that is happening in some places. Like I wrote about the sugar tax in Philadelphia.
And the Netherlands, that a fat tax, right? A tax on saturated fat. Was it Norway or Holland? One of those places. Yeah. So, I mean, clearly we don't, anyone who's listening to this show probably doesn't trust the government to make those choices. They've done a spectacularly bad job at figuring this stuff out in the past. And so why would we want to support them in doing that? I mean, that was my first response. And still, you know, I still feel that way in a lot of respects. But then I started to think about it further. And I considered, what if there was, if we just think of something that's different, not a food based thing, but you know, what if a parent was giving their child a poison that was known to, you know, reduce IQ, cause brain damage, stunt growth, you know, put them at higher risk for virtually every kind of a disease, both in childhood and later on in their adult life? We would frown pretty heavily on that. You know, we would probably call that abuse. And certainly neglect, and parents have definitely been put in jail for less than that. I mean, I know parents have been put in jail for far less than that, and for various decisions related to, like, you know, withholding medications from their children, for example, like some religious groups that don't believe in pharmaceutical drugs, or giving their kids supplements, even in some cases, that the conventional paradigm didn't think were appropriate in that situation. So it's, on the other hand, you know, that same argument could have been used for parents who fed their kids cholesterol and saturated fat, if, you know, at the time when it was still believed that those were harmful. Maybe not to, you know, those were never associated with brain damage or anything like that. It was, you know, maybe a distant increase in heart disease later in life. But I'll just say it's a very thorny and complicated issue. And at the end of the day, whatever the solution is or the consequences, I think the thing that needs to happen first before any of that is, or more urgently, is to increase people's awareness of what the consequences of this stuff are. Because then parents can take appropriate action and
form decisions.
Yeah, yeah, hopefully. And if they don't, then that's really more of a kind of social, legal, philosophical decision about what happens with them. And that's not something I feel like I have a lot of expertise in or I've thought very deeply about. But I just will acknowledge here that those consequences are very real and underappreciated and misunderstood. So that's where I feel like I can, and we can contribute.
Yes. And I mean, my whole point to the talk I did at AHS, where I was pointing out, you know, what's going on with the US dietary guidelines, you know, because it's very vegetarian focused, and there's some lines in there. This can be made vegan by, you know, substituting more soy for the eggs and dairy. It's really, really dangerous. And it's not only dangerous, you know, to US citizens, but all the other countries that want to be just like us and follow us.
Yeah.
And I think that if somebody doesn't put a lot of thought behind it and decide that it's complicated, then they're not truly thinking. And I actually ended up texting Rob over the week or whenever, I forget when, yeah, over this weekend, because I was getting really mad at some of the responses. You know, people had these very knee-jerk, well, I don't want government at all, you know. And I don't think people were fully understanding how complicated it is. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like people weren't, I was just really upset about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, luckily, like, I just sent you this link to an NPR story about how in Germany, which is, veganism is really, really popular over there, but there's a bunch of dietitians that are pushing back. And I think that dietitians here need to really push back. And I know that, you know, during my education to become an RD, it was very not PC to eat meat. And it was all the professors were vegetarian, and there was a lot of young vegan women in my program, like a lot of vegans. And so it's very hip, it's very fashionable. And it seems like the moral, you know, the pure way to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely problematic. I think, you know, one of the interesting considerations here is this kind of the social and cultural aspects, which you're kind of hinting at here, because I know that article talked about the kind of glam factor of being vegan. I mean, there's the celebrity angle and people who make a choice not really because they've deeply investigated it from a nutritional or environmental or moral ethical standpoint, but because some celebrity that they admire is doing it. And unfortunately, that is, I would say, probably the most common reason that people adopt a diet, which is why if you've ever written a book on nutrition, your publisher wants you to like point to celebrities that are doing that kind of approach. I mean, this is the way the world works, unfortunately. It's a problem because, like you said, if these choices are not thoroughly investigated, they can have pretty dire consequences. So, you know, that's something that all we can do is keep providing this information. And ultimately, for me at least, it's I don't feel, with the exception of kids, which I do, that's where it changes for me. I don't really try to convince anyone, any adult of anything at this point, you know, related to diet. I just, you know, I say, here's the information that I have, you know, in the scientific literature, what it says, and, you know, make your own decision, knock yourself out. But when it comes to kids, I think what you were getting at, and Drew were getting at, is like, we have a moral imperative to protect this future generation. And that shows up in our law in so many other places. you know, and parents are held responsible for how they educate their kids. Like if you just decide to take your kid out of school and you don't have a plan, you know, you can be put in jail in some places, you know, and that's neglect. So there really are, it's a different moral equation or calculation when it comes to kids.
Right. And I want to make it clear, I'm not saying I definitely think parents should be jailed for this. I'm also not saying that I think a junk food diet is okay. You know, I got a lot of these accusations, so I'm not saying any of these things. Another panelist suggested that maybe it's the role of community and that his church, you know, there's a woman who was feeding her kids vegan and these kids were really, you know, teeny, and the church members had an intervention. And unfortunately, we just don't have tight communities like that anymore.
Yeah, particularly in large urban environments, which tend to be more secular, that's not really going to work. You know, in a rural community or a community where the church plays that kind of role, that's fantastic. And I'm a big advocate of that level of community, you know, support. But yeah, like you said, it's not going to work in a lot of places. Last thing I'll say about this, because this is fresh on my mind, is, you know, I'm writing an article right now about DHA, which is one of the nutrients that vegetarians and particularly vegans are most at risk for being deficient in if they're not supplementing with preformed DHA. And when we talk about a nutrient that's essential for kids and particularly the developing fetus, this is like at the top of the list, right? Something like, you know, large percentage of the dry weight of the brain is DHA. It's crucial for development of visual acuity, for spatial intelligence. DHA deficiency has been associated with lower IQ, problem-solving ability. It's just completely essential. And there's a myth going around that in the vegetarian and vegan community that if you eat flax seeds or walnuts or some of these plant-based forms of omega-3, that the body can convert those into DHA, no problem, right? But when you actually look deeper, you see that that conversion is extremely inefficient, less than, you know, 2-5% of alpha-linolenic acid, which is the fat that's in the plant-based foods, is converted into DHA. And that's kind of a best case scenario because the enzymes that are required for that conversion need a lot of different nutrients like vitamin B6 and iron and zinc and calcium and things that actually a lot of vegans and vegetarians can, you know, can be deficient in. And there are genetic differences, there are sex differences. Women convert far more ALA to DHA, which is probably nature's way of making sure that they had enough DHA, even if they didn't have access to preformed DHA. Some men have been shown to convert 0% of ALA to DHA. So, and one study I saw, it was 0% for men and 9% for women. So if you take an average, that's 4.5%, right? And that's what they report in the study. But the average doesn't tell you that men are converting 0%. So, you know, this explains why, because sometimes you'll hear people say, well, how can a vegan diet can't be bad for you? Because I see people, you know, I have a friend, you know, Jane, that switched to a vegan diet 6 months ago and she's thriving. Well, number one, what did she switch from? You know, number two, it's possible that she has these genetic, you know, some genetic differences, and also just the nature of her being female make it less likely that she's going to immediately become deficient in some of these things. And number three, we have to remember that many of these deficiencies take months or years to develop.
Or show up on the blood panels, right?
Right.
Like B12.
Right. And so someone who does well initially may not do well in 3 or 4 years, but the problem is they're not going to tie it to their diet change at that point because they'd already been doing that, you know, for a significant period of time. So this is very complex, and there are a lot of, you know, the arguments as usual in the interwebs tend to be pretty superficial and not really consider all of these angles. So thank you so much for coming on and talking about this stuff, and maybe we should do we'll have you back for another show about CAFO meat problems with confinement feeding operations for animal products.
The antibacterial superbugs that's a really interesting topic, and I saw the film Resistance, which was great, and I had the director on my show, but that might be a nice guest for you to have as well in the
mm-hmm.
future.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Really great.
Okay, well, thanks again, Diana. Appreciate your time. And where can people learn more about your work and what you're up to?
Yes, my website is sustainabledish.com, and all my books and my podcast and How to See Me as a Patient are all right there.
Great. Good luck, and we'll look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
That's the end of this episode of Revolution Health Radio. If you appreciate the show and want to help me create a healthier and happier world, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They really do make a difference. If you'd like to ask a question for me to answer on a future episode, you can do that at chriskresser.com/podcastquestion. You can also leave a suggestion for someone you'd like me to interview there. If you're on social media, you can follow me at twitter.com/chriskresser or facebook.com/chriskresserlac. I post a lot of articles and research that I do throughout the week there that never makes it to the blog or podcast, so it's a great way to stay abreast of the latest developments. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.